This podcast is made possible through listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. And the Florence County Museum, presenting Edward Gay, an American landscape painter, chronicling Gay's evolving style amid the turn of the 20th century and his unique connections to South Carolina and the National Academy of Design, now through February 23rd, flococomuseum.org. And Meadow Garden, home of George Walton, one of the youngest signers of the Declaration of Independence. Open for tours Monday through Friday, 10 to 4. Learn more at historicmeadowgarden.org and visit augusta.com.
From South Carolina Public Radio, this is Walter Edgar's Journal. I'm Walter Edgar, welcoming you to our podcast series about South Carolina culture and history with a nod to all things Southern. Today, Alfred Turner and I will be talking with Vernon Burton and Brent Morris of Clemson University about their book, Reconstruction Beyond 150, Reassessing the New Birth of Freedom.
No period of United States history is more important and still less understood than Reconstruction. Now, at the sesquicentennial of the Reconstruction era, Vernon Burton and Brent Morris bring together the best new scholarship on the critical years after the Civil War and before the onset of Jim Crow.
Even though many of the gains of Reconstruction were rolled back and replaced with a repressive social and legal regime for African Americans, the radical spark was never fully extinguished. Its spirit was fanned back into flame with the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s. Vernon and Brent, it's great to have you both back on the Journal, and particularly to talk about your latest joint venture, Reconstruction Beyond 150, Reassessing the New Birth of Freedom. First of all, how did you all come up with this particular subject?
Well, it was a project that was a long time in coming, but it actually was a result of the first of what's now been five National Endowment for the Humanities Teachers Institutes on the Reconstruction era. And this was the first one in 2015 in Beaufort, and Vernon was one of the visiting faculty members. And I was looking at our schedule one day and realized, you know, we've got a lot of big names on this piece of paper, and why don't we bring them all together and produce something that's going to be useful to the people of the Institute, but also anybody that's interested in the Reconstruction era down the road. So we solicited some essays from a lot of other people. We figured out what the directions we thought the Reconstruction scholarship might be going, and the rest is history.
And well, as you know, I have always argued that Reconstruction is the least understood and yet the most important period of American history. And I so admire what Brent did with his institute. When he was talking about the institute, these are high school or public school teachers. And I think he's done more in those five seminars, which you often were part of and gave sort of the concluding and keynote, Walter, so you're familiar with it. He did so much more to bring about a better understanding of Reconstruction among the people who are really doing God's work, that is, teaching in the public schools and getting the interpretations of Reconstruction and away from the sort of lost cause mythology that we all grew up with more than I think anyone else that I know of, certainly in our profession. So I really admire that and wanted to help in any way I could.
Well, one of the things that people still debate is how many Reconstructions, and I just want to talk for a second about my graduate career. You all now, generally, people are talking about three Reconstructions. Well, Bill Foran was talking about three Reconstructions back in 1965 at the University of South Carolina. There was the post-Civil War Reconstruction, then the New Deal, because he said, particularly in the American South, society was reconstructed to an extent. Then the civil rights movement was going on in the 1960s. He said that was the third one. But several of your authors in this book don't include the New Deal. They make the civil rights movement the second Reconstruction, and now they're talking about there is a third Reconstruction. I want you to dip a little bit about that, because I can't get my hands on why it's the third Reconstruction now.
Well, now versus when we started this book together, I think that interpretation might have changed a bit. But thinking about the New Deal as a second Reconstruction makes a lot of sense. You have a lot of the same issues at play, very important political issues too. But the third Reconstruction really did, to us, sort of seemed to be almost within our grasp when we started this project.
When was that when you started?
We started this in 2015.
Okay, so it's been a while.
It's been a while. Well, the original title that we proposed was Reconstruction at 150. So it took so long it had to go to beyond 150. But but we were, you know, looking at the world around us sort of as it evolved, and a lot of the same questions that were important Reconstruction questions seemed to be important 2015 questions. And we thought, you know, this is a great opportunity to bring these stories together in. And that's the part of the really important relevance of the first Reconstruction is how often those issues keep coming up and coming up and coming up, never fully resolved. But I do remember in 2016, I got a call from Vernon wanting to know if we had just witnessed the second redemption, the end of the third Reconstruction, maybe before it even got off its feet.
Yeah. And I think there was a period of time, remember, Barack Obama's elected president. You're dealing with a number of the issues that were so important in Reconstruction. And I do want to say, Walter, the New Deal, I think you're absolutely right, has to be seen in the South at least. And I think the whole idea of the long civil rights movement that's been introduced sort of has co-opted and thinks, well, it goes back into the New Deal. So I think that may be part of the
All right. Well, let's talk about the issues that come from the first Reconstruction, both Civil War, and reappear in American history. So, Brent, what are those issues primarily?
No, there's a handful. Voting rights.
Voting rights.
Who's able to go to the polls and cast a vote and be a full citizen.
Okay.
Citizenship. Who is included, and by the letter of the law, who's included as part of the United States of American citizenry. You also have to deal with issues of domestic terrorism. Political violence was you know, one of the common issues in Reconstruction. It leads to the downfall of the first Reconstruction, and it's something, unfortunately, we still have to look out for.
And you can add, too, people forget, but you had the recession, and, of course, part of what happened to Reconstruction at the time was a depression, recession that hit the American South well before it became the Great Depression of 1873 or the 1890s, depending on how you define Reconstruction. And those were also issues that brought out how both politics influenced economics and social structure, as well as how the economy and people's place in it and what they perceived was happening to them influenced their politics.
Getting back to the first Reconstruction, there is debate as to when that first Reconstruction ended. I found several of the essays fascinating. Traditionally, Vernon, and we are the same age through graduate school, 1877, when federal troops were withdrawn from South Carolina, although they were withdrawn from other states earlier. So, but 1877, but some of your contributors carry Reconstruction on into the 1880s.
And I think it goes even further, and there's a new book by Manisha Sinha, who also wrote on South Carolina, that takes it to the 18th Amendment and women's rights. So it's how you define it. But I really do think, Walter, we've lost sort of seeing the way we teach history, that the troops they aren't really removed from South Carolina, federal troops, just not very many, yeah. But they aren't there to protect anymore. They're not going to support the Republican government, and then Wade Hampton becomes governor of South Carolina. But the real, I think, shift for me comes with the two court cases, the one much more famous, of course, Plessy v. Ferguson in 1896, but particularly 1898, Williams versus Mississippi, Mississippi versus Williams, which says it's okay to disfranchise and segregate as long as you don't say you're doing it because of race. You can use other criteria that have the same effect. And I think that, to me, is probably the critical point. But there are different kinds of Reconstruction. I wish we'd had a little more of the kind of work that Gaines Foster did, that there was a religious Reconstruction. There's an economic Reconstruction. There are institutional, church, all these sorts of things that go out and sort of come under the umbrella of Reconstruction.
Well, one of the things that there are a number of the essays I really enjoyed, but the essay about Senator Morton from Indiana, who called Reconstruction a continuation of the Civil War. You may remember in my history, I did not entitle my chapter Reconstruction. I had the Civil War Part 1 and the Civil War Part 2.
Yeah, and when I teach South Carolina with that book, that's the way I teach it as well. Talking about the end of Reconstruction, you know, how can you really point to the end of the Civil War? It's just, it's war by other means that happens during the Reconstruction era.
As I argued in the Age of Lincoln, in my favorite example, it seems like smoking gun evidence, if we want to use sort of a evidentiary base, that people who did not participate in the Civil War, most too young, but then they rode with the Red Shirts, which is a paramilitary group actually commanded by the Hampton Legion officers and generals. They then applied to the state of South Carolina for Confederate pensions, arguing and believing that in 1876 and a couple in 1878 that they were fighting for the Confederacy in the Civil War.
Did they get the pension?
I tried to figure it out, and I have not yet. But I found I looked at two states just to check for the age of Lincoln. South Carolina, of course, which I studied most. But in Louisiana, I found the same thing. It's very sort of interesting. The other thing that is Don Doyle's essay, which says, you know, this international sort of transnational reconstruction. I think that's another element that's pretty exciting.
Well, I must say that I think the essay that I was most fascinated by, though, was Mark Twain and the Failure of Reconstruction. And I would like y'all to go into that because, first of all, the title grabs you, and then the author, I think, makes a pretty good case.
Yeah, Mills Thornton's essay in the book. It was one thing I really wanted to have in the book was something just besides straight history, really getting into, you know, the literature and how it affected and how it was affected by the period. And I think that's a really interesting essay that he takes it back into, you know, centuries ago, but sort of into this Mark Twain's Connecticut Yankee and sort of shows the parallels between, you know, what was going on in Twain's writing there and what was actually happening in Reconstruction at the same time. Of course, he was living through it.
Yes, you're talking about a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. Which is presented always as a fable, which Mills Thornton was arguing it was.
Right.
And let's just remind people what happens to this Connecticut Yankee. He goes back in time and space, correct?
He does.
And Mills, I've always loved his work. I've always thought he was probably the best when the idea of little R republicanism was introduced in the antebellum South and other things. And this is just a very creative essay, and it makes you think a lot. And also to understand how literature and history work together, I think, or can work together and show us things that historians necessarily can't bring evidence forward to, but literary artists like our own Pat Conroy was sort of a genius at doing. Yeah.
Well, Thornton, the author, actually talks about Twain's trilogy, Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn, and then the Connecticut Yankee.
Yeah. Twain is a great character to look at. He always has something to add to any point of American history when you're looking at the 19th century, even into the 20th century. He's great for a good quote, too, even though most that's attributed to him he wasn't actually responsible for.
But I love the way there's sort of a conclusion. Remember, he is the one who publishes Ulysses S. Grant's memoirs, and they become friends. And it goes back to, apparently, as I understand it, it was Grant when he told that it was because he deserted from the Confederacy that the South lost the war, not because of Grant's generalship, and they had that sort of running joke among themselves.
So with the Connecticut Yankee, tie this to Reconstruction for me, because I haven't read the essay, just briefly.
There is a very good paragraph, and I think this will explain it.
Great.
the conflict between Twain's affectionate memories of his childhood and his clarified understanding of the injustice that had given form to his world dominates Tom Sawyer's sequel, Huckleberry Finn, which appeared in 1885. In Huckleberry Finn, the warmly humorous surface is at every moment prepared to crack to reveal a dark and violent substrate of callous cruelty, vicious exploitation, and ignorance. For all its ability to bring this conflict vividly to life, Huckleberry Finn offers no solutions. We are left, as Twain was also, to recognize and accept the coexistence of both levels of reality as Huck had experienced them. And that inevitably led Twain, who had just lived through the failure of Reconstruction, to muse on the possibility of transforming such a society. The result was a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court, and Twain published that in 1889. It is a novel about the capacity of the modernizing democratic faith of a Connecticut Yankee to reform the recalcitrant reality of a world with very different assumptions and ideals. It is, in other words, an allegory about the possibility of Reconstruction.
All right. I will see that from now on in a different light.
Well, in a lot of ways, that's what... You know, the what-ifs of history are the best questions that people can ask, and Mark Twain is asking that. You know, looking at what it must have been like to reconstruct a people and with an ideology that's sort of set in its ways.
And a people he was a part of.
He was a part of it.
I do think he was a Southern writer out of Missouri, and with some, and understanding how difficult it is to change the way people believe. I mean, it's not just a ruse, but they have long held theological worldviews and social ideas that are not easily reconstructed.
I've often taught Reconstruction, not necessarily only as congressional or radical Reconstruction and presidential Reconstruction, but I've looked at it two ways as being literal Reconstruction, putting the pieces back together, rebuilding, but also that second type of Reconstruction, ideological, which is so much harder and turned out to be the sort of thing that Americans didn't quite have the bandwidth for in the 1870s to see it through. That ideological Reconstruction to convince people that, you know, the whole life that they had known and their fathers and fathers before them and grandfathers was not the way that America was going to go into the next century.
Well, one of the problems, though, Brent, I really believe is there was a legal structure to make it work, that the courts sort of undid. I like to make an argument that there was a wall built with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, carefully layered with bricks or stones. Then the Enforcement Acts, the 1875 Civil Rights Act, not including the others as well. And then there was a series of court cases. As we just spoke about the Plessy v. Ferguson and the Williams v. Mississippi on voting and on segregation, but even more important, these other cases like the Cruikshank case, which decided that the Colfax massacre was okay, that you could not put in federal court someone who had murdered black people or Republicans, they were Democrat, if they were not part of the state, that is, state militia, highway patrol, sheriff, or some direct thing, which was like a green flag to go ahead and murder people because your local, where we get back to the local situation, juries and things are not going to find them guilty in a state court.
Yeah.
Particularly when black people have been excluded from the jury by one of those rulings.
Right. I mean, you see the teeth being taken away from most of the biggest steps forward in That's Reconstruction. Right. And one thing you notice, too, is when laws have to be passed over and over again and when amendments and other laws are tested in the courts, that means that they're not being followed in the way that the people that drafted them meant them to be.
And one of the other things I was thinking about when you're talking about the similarities are, too, you know, we were moving from a farming economy into a manufacturing economy. And then when you and I were starting the book, we were moving from sort of that manufacturing economy to a new technological, different kind of world. And one of the big issues that gets left out, and one of the important points that Eric Foner early made in his great book, Reconstruction, is the sort of labor unrest, particularly in the North, but also labor unrest in the South. The issues were of labor, of who's going to work these farms, who's going to get paid what, and how are you going to reconstruct what had been a plantation society primarily, at least in many of the states. And so many people feeling completely unsettled as where they were and what their place was in society. Very similar that got tapped into in that 2016 election that I think was going on with a different political party, the Democrats.
Well, I was thinking when you're talking about agriculture, not only in the South did you go from enslaved labor to either tenantry or sharecropping. And by the way, that was for white folks too.
That's right.
Which people do. But that was also beginning to happen in the Midwest. The idea of the yeoman farmer as the backbone of society, economic factors were saying, you're not going to be able to survive by yourself. You're going to end up working for somebody else.
Mm-hmm. You know, working for somebody else or getting eaten up by a, you know, industrial-sized farm.
And in fact, the whole tenantry system, we forget, it begins in Jamestown, Virginia, and it had been a way to move from maybe the son of a farm owner or someone who didn't own land to gain land. And it just changed dramatically after the Civil War in terms of that, and also the rules about who got paid first in a bad economy and that economic depression. And of course, for most of the South, or at least the part we know the best, cotton just tanked after the Civil War, because during the Civil War, other areas had developed cotton.
Of course, the rice industry disappeared completely. South Carolina could not compete with what was being grown in Arkansas and Texas. And then the introduction of tobacco in the 1880s, which for many people in the Peedy area of South Carolina was a godsend. When Shaw introduced his Orinoco tobacco, right, he was getting 10 times the return per acre that a cotton farmer would get. That worked in the Peedy. It didn't work in the rest of the right state.
And it's interesting, don't go too far afield, but how some of those tobacco farmers built new wealth and a new sort of economic elite, and this carried forward even today among some people in the PD region and thing that we haven't really studied like we need to.
But all of that economic turmoil, as you're talking about, it's a reconstruction of the Jeffersonian ideal of the yeoman farmer is the backbone of American society. So the concept that there's more than one reconstruction, not just political, I think is a fascinating part of the many topics that are covered in this book. Well, back to our graduate student days, Vernon. The traditional ending of 1877 focuses on the few hundred troops, federal troops left in South Carolina being withdrawn, and the deal cut so that Rutherford B. Hayes can become president and Wade Hampton can become governor.
Yeah, I've always said South Carolina is the way to study this era, not just because I'm from it and studied with you, but it's really fascinating that you can, and Eric Foner, you know, himself did this. He came to South Carolina. He was a visiting professor at USC and got into the archives and realized that there was a lot to this story, and it all starts in South Carolina. And now with new studies, the way that people are looking at Reconstruction, you push the beginning back a little bit. I mean, I think Foner himself starts at the end of the Civil War, but 1861 is the Battle of Port Royal Sound and the beginnings of that Port Royal experiment. 1877, right, is when the end of federal Reconstruction happens. But you can look to South Carolina and see how Reconstruction, or at least the ideas or coalition politics, last until the late 19th century.
So Reconstruction has cast quite a shadow over South Carolina's political decisions for years after it, even years after there was no longer a majority black population.
1922 was the year that South Carolina was declared a white majority state.
And I'm reading a book manuscript for a friend now who disagrees with me, as you know, my argument, Walter, when he says the South ended. There's no more South. When in 1970 you had more African Americans coming into the state of South Carolina than leaving. And there's something to that, but I think there's a lot more to the South than just the percent of a proportion of African Americans leaving or coming.
Well, and of course, how long is it going to be before Native South Carolinians are outnumbered by the folks who come here from somewhere else. Yeah. South Carolina is the fastest growing state percentage-wise in the country now. Sorry, Texas.
And I hate to interrupt you, but we're moving toward the end of our time together. So anything else you want to talk about besides the number of reconstructions and such?
Well, I mean, they're the ends of Reconstruction. I guess we can get back to that. It's hard to put a bookend on the idea of Reconstruction. Looking at what was going on during these Reconstructions, it's clear that Americans have a short attention span, and it doesn't take much to kind of throw them off their game. So whether it's an economic downturn in 1873, which is the beginning of the end of federal Reconstruction, or whether it's the pulling out of troops, or you know, who knows what. But it's just that the ending point cannot be pointed to necessarily, because there's always the memory and the influence of what had happened before. There's always the children and the grandchildren of Reconstruction leaders that pick up the torch again in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, and I think Walt and I've talked about this before. I don't know if I have with you, Brent, but you know, Dr. Benjamin E. Mays, whose parents were enslaved, talks about having the pictures of Reconstruction leaders on their walls of their homes, tenant shacks, basically, knowing the stories. And it's not until the 1930s that many of these Reconstruction leaders are dying. When I looked at Edgefield, it's 1930s for Paris Simpkins. It's still there. So you get an idea. We forget just how short a time span. Charles Joyner used to tell me about, he remembered that in his area of Conway growing up, there were Civil War veterans who were on the streets with one arm and things like this, that how we come out of our history is not just we jump back in a textbook, but people live generations and they overlap.
Yeah, the study of history is the study of continuity and change. And with Reconstruction, that continuity is always there.
Brent, I understand you've got a new project going on up at Clemson. What is that?
Well, we're hoping to establish something along the lines of this, you know, the Institute for Southern Studies that I was so influenced by. But being able to have at Clemson an institute for the study of South Carolina, history and culture. We've got an amazing faculty up there that, and you know, in history and literature and social sciences, that have focused on different areas of South Carolina and their scholarship. And there's so much there to be contributed to understanding of American history, of Southern history, of world history, and South Carolina being sort of the center of all that. So we're trying to create an institute that streamlines that creates sort of an umbrella for these other departments to come in and help us out, but to get as many of these stories told as possible.
And to do the kind of NEH workshops, or maybe workshops ever how they're funded for public school teachers who are just begging for help on how do you teach South Carolina history, I think. And though it's aspirational, I think it's really a great idea. We want to work with the sort of local history societies and genealogy societies. Public memory is a big study now. How do you commemorate things? There's such contentious issues, and we really believe that you can work together to get the truth, because I think evidence, you know, the truth is what sets us free. I truly believe that. That's, I think, one of the things we can do there. It's also part of our deans of College of Arts and Humanities. Also an aspiration to create a humanities center at Clemson, then we would sort of be a part of that and working through it to reach out. We're a land-grant school, and part of what you're supposed to do as a land-grant school is to reach out to the communities.
One of the things that I really look forward to with the South Carolina Institute is the public-facing work. Because so much that we do as scholars, we write books for the, you know, the same 50 people that are going to read them and talk amongst ourselves about them. But when you actually can engage with the descendant communities, we can actually engage with the folks whose families have been part of these stories. It really can advance the sort of things that we do in our own, you know, ivory tower of academia. Because the lag between what historians are saying happened and here's the truth and here are the facts, and what, you know, the average person on the street understands is great. So to be able to sort of make that gap smaller, to be able to bring students, to be able to bring, you know, just people from the community closer to an accurate understanding of history is huge.
It's time for us to wind up. So Brent, any last words?
Just, you know, the last words of the book, and that Reconstruction is a topic that's very important. It was important then. It was important for the century after, and it still gives us ways to think about questions that began in the 1860s and haven't gone away.
Vernon?
Well, I think my last words are how excited I am to have Brent Morris there at Clemson with his commitment to history and to reaching out to the public, and his belief that's certainly mine, that it makes a difference, and it's important that it people understand history and the truth. As my sainted mother always said, you sweep your dirt under the rug, you're going to trip over it eventually. So we're trying to get that dirt out from under the rug. We've done our share of tripping over in South Carolina.
Well, Vernon Burton and Brent Morris, I want to thank you both for being with us again today on The Journal. I hope you enjoyed our conversation today. I know that I did. It was a pleasure to talk with Vernon Burton and Brent Morris. In their book, Reconstruction Beyond 150, Reassessing the New Birth of Freedom, Vernon and Brent have brought together the best new scholarship, synthesizing social, political, economic, and cultural approaches to understanding a crucial period in our country's history.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. I'm Alfred Turner, and I produce the show, which is made possible by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. Remember, the views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio or its underwriters.
New episodes of Walter Edgar's Journal are published on the first and third Fridays of the month and are available at southcarolinapublicradio.org, on the SCETV app, as well as your favorite podcast provider. We'll talk again soon.